With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Simply go to tntradio.live. Perspective with Jesse Zurawell on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome to Perspective. I'm Jesse Zurawell, your host for the hour. Michael Bryant joins me once again today. Michael is a New York-based activist and journalist whose writings can be found, among other places, at offguardian.org. Michael, welcome back. How are you?
Doing pretty well. Thanks for having me, Jesse.
Absolutely. One of the things we touched on in our last conversation was the huge pivot that the pharma or biotech industry has made and is continuing to make toward mRNA technology. And we touched on the reason for this being because of the huge loss in revenue from the old model of doing things, particularly with regard to so-called vaccines. There has been a loss in revenue because of the time it takes to develop products and market them and license them. And mRNA, if we go by the official narrative, is a godsend for the industry because it cuts out a lot, if not all of that, which also cuts out a lot, if not all, of the safety and reliability, if there are any, that comes with these products. So I want to start there and just to point out examples of this. Moderna recently announced that it is poised to create 2,000 new jobs as its mRNA prospects for cancer and RSV heat up. This is according to fiercepharma.com. While that's happening, recently the CEO of Moderna announced at Davos at the World Economic Forum's annual meeting that Moderna is in talks to do business with China, and also Moderna seeks to have an mRNA production facility on every continent. And as if that's not enough, the FDA is currently outlining a plan for annual COVID boosters, as they call them. And this is a plan to turn the COVID-19 injection into an annual injection, much like the flu one has been for quite some time. So I want to get into the nitty-gritty of this because I know this is something you've been looking at. And let me first ask you, why is this the case? I know I just mentioned the loss of revenue, but are there other reasons affiliated with this besides just revenue?
Well, I would start there and start with the understanding that, you know, pharma's business model is essentially broken, and they've known this, they've realized this for a decade now. And, you know, they're seeing a pretty steady decline on their return of investments due to a number of reasons. And so they have been looking for a way to change this trend. And they're also up against some patent windows, and they are also kind of at a loss for hunting down new microbes. So in essence, the entire formula that they've been using for the last few decades has hit a couple of brick walls. So they're looking to get around that so that they can get more of the market share, get more investors interested. And that is one of the primary, it's the primary reason for their interest in launching, you know, this biotech revolution in the pharmaceutical industry. And through using the mRNA technologies as a delivery mechanism, what they're looking to do, and it looks like they're going to be doing this, is they're going to eliminate a lot of regulatory processes. They're going to eliminate a lot of research and development, particularly costs, particularly with phase three clinical trials. They want to get rid of those. Phase three clinical trials take up in total 40% of all pharmaceutical costs when we're talking about time to market, from lab to pharmacy. And that's for the products overall. For the products that make it through that process, phase three clinical trials, drugs that are approved, phase three clinical trials take up 90% or more of total costs. So they're looking to wipe that out and turn the mRNA platforms into a delivery mechanism that is essentially downloadable, you know, a subscription model for the pharma cartel that can be, you know, they can just shift proteins from one miracle cure to the next, and then have these out to market, you know, within months, you know, whether it's for melanoma, for your liver, for you know, the next flu, quote unquote, and so forth. So in short, that's the entire program that they're putting forth here with the mRNA subscription model that pharma is pursuing and which they're pushing, which they're putting in place.
There are lots of questions to ask about this. Obviously, one of them being, is this technology, has it been proven to work? I would answer that with a resounding no. And also the question of, who's going to take these products after what we've witnessed over the last 2 years with the COVID-19 injections, which, by the way, in a Reuters article about Moderna doing business with China, Reuters calls Moderna's COVID-19 injections successful, quote unquote. They've been anything but successful. That's not an opinion. That's objective truth. So a lot of people, including myself, first ask, who's going to go for these new serums? And that's when my mind goes to the World Health Organization and what it's trying to do to position itself as a global governance body that will enable the weaponization of so-called pandemics to continue, and weaponizing them in such a way where it will make what's happened over the last 3 years look like a cakewalk, where there will be forced injections much more so than we've seen this time around. That said, I want to get your take on that, because there's obviously a lot of money going into this. There are a lot of facilities being set up. Moderna is setting up a huge facility in the UK in furtherance of this. And it's not just Moderna we're talking about. There are other big entities. Pfizer, BioNTech is also charting a similar course. But how do you think this is going to look going forward, given the very questionable nature of the technology and the disaster for humanity it's produced so far.
My take on that is that perhaps it's just a little bit of a semantic difference in semantics. I do think the products have been safe and effective, and by that I'm looking at it from the vantage point of, you know, these psychotic billionaires and the pharmaceutical cartel, and they're safe from being prosecuted from anything because they have governments protecting them, and they are effective in generating extraordinary amounts of revenue. I forget the numbers. For Pfizer, it was quite high. I think Moderna's around $18.4 billion that they made last year with these things. So in a sense, I don't think at this point, who is going to take them is as much the issue as who is going to foot the bill. So success for you and me is defined quite a bit differently than what success is for these individuals. And I think it's important that we keep in mind, I think we touched upon this last time, that the pharmaceutical industry is not a standalone entity. It's intertwined with the Department of Defense. It's intertwined with all sorts of hedge fund investors. It's intertwined with government institutions. It has all these layers of cottage industries beneath it as well. So the way that much of this gets funded is through the taxes, through the taxpayers. So they don't even necessarily have to have large uptake. Okay, they can say, you know what, we're gonna export these miracles for dysentery to India. We're going to export these mRNA miracles for malaria to Africa, and so on and so forth. And they're going to put that financial burden on the back of the taxpayers in the West. And, you know, they can just poison a small subsection, as they have done many, many times before, of folks in other parts of the world. And they can throw the rest of it in the ocean as long as they get their return on investment. And then by the time all the detritus has been cleared up, they've walked out the back door with the bags of money, and then they've moved on to their next scheme. So that's a pattern. That's not, you know, that's really not being cynical or not speculative. That's what they've done over and over again. So with that in mind, I don't know that the technologies per se have to be effective. There's nothing for them to be effective against. Okay.
Right.
The diseases that they're supposedly hunting down, microbes that they're pursuing so nobly, are fictitious entities. So that they are doing this classic strategy of problem, reaction, solution. You know, they're the ones busting out the window in your store, stealing all your stuff, and then coming back to you the next day, and they're saying, hey, I saw that you had a robbery in here yesterday. If you pay me X amount of money, I'll protect you from those robberies in the future.
Yes, it's interesting that you bring up that analogy, because I just read that very same analogy in one of Sasha Latipova's recent pieces. Maybe you read that as well, and that's why it's fresh on your mind. I don't know. But that is what we're talking about here. And before we get into the viral delusion aspect of it, I want to touch on digitization, because in the Fierce Pharma article I mentioned, it reads, in part, the hiring push comes as Moderna quests to digitize its manufacturing operations, which could take the form of digital control systems or even robotics, Collins pointed out. And Collins is the new chief technical officer at Moderna. Moderna is currently weighing the potential of machines to chip in on portions of the production process, such as fill and finish, he said. And I bring this up because this is a concomitant and intertwined acceleration we're seeing, along with the acceleration of the mRNA technology. And interestingly, this Fierce Pharma article quotes the CTO of Moderna using the word accelerate. He asks, how do we accelerate from here? And this, to me, all points toward the future that the globalist predator class, the technocrats, are trying to build a wholly digital transhumanist and then post-human future. So I'm wondering if you have anything to say about that, even if we didn't know about the desire to herd most of the world's populations into a transhumanist, post-humanist future. This on its face, this alone on its face would be frightening to consider, having machines and robots responsible for much of the manufacturing of these already disastrous concoctions. So I'd like to get your thoughts on that, if you have any.
Just general thought, you know, I guess on these kind of discussions around AI, transhumanism, I'm probably a little more optimistic than, you know, many of the people I have these discussions with. It won't work. You know, humanity and life is just far messier and, you know, I guess wonderfully unpredictable than these psychotic technocrats believe or can even comprehend based on the worlds that they inhabit. So I would say that, you know, maybe sometimes with those stories that are being, you know, implanted into our heads, it's a bit of an attempt at social engineering to get us almost to think that these things are a fait accompli, and, you know, humanity is going to be turned into these robots, and, you know, the digital world is going to take over everything. And it there certainly is an acceleration of the surveillance states and robotics and all this sort of stuff. But, you know, much of that depends on this massive infrastructure that, again, will cause quite a bit of damage as it's attempting to put into place. But I just don't see, you know, how that's going to be sustained. I don't see how. I maybe have a more positive view of the human spirit, even if sometimes it looks somewhat bleak out there. So I don't foresee that being able to sustain itself. You know, a lot of the world that we're conditioned to see or believe is the world that's being narrated to us by these individuals who have all of this control of the media and this power. So I think we have to be very careful there and accepting that as, you know, the only narrative that is out there. And then I would, you know, finish, I guess, with these people live their lives almost exclusively in these little bubbles. You know, they believe that virtually everything that they see, hear, and touch on their computer screen is real. You know, there's a whole host of engineers, technocrats, scientists that believe, you know, whatever they can do in their lab with their little experiment is going to translate out into the world, and that is real. And for the most part, that's not the case.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to know where how much progress has been made. And I say progress not in a positive sense, but simply in terms of how advanced this project is, this transhumanist, completely digital future project. But we certainly know it's what the powers that ought not be want. So we do need to stay vigilant in terms of what's happening. But I agree with you that it's probably not as far along as we're led to believe, even through a lot of independent media, which is not to say we shouldn't be worried about it or shouldn't, again, keep an eye on it. But as you said, we shouldn't treat it like a fait accompli. And I think the mRNA technology provides a perfect example of this, because even in a lot of independent media, the narrative is that the technology works, that the mRNA sequences bound up in lipid nanoparticles are able to enter human cells and create a synthetic spike protein that produces an antibody response, but this process goes awry because the spike protein is so toxic and the mRNA never stops entering the cells and never stops, at least based on studies that have been done, never stops producing the spike protein. But if you look at the work of the Italian microbiologist Stefano Scolio, he's pointed out that there's no proof in the literature that this technology is able to get into human cells and create the spike protein, which is not to say the lipid nanoparticles themselves aren't toxic and deadly, but there's no proof that they get into cells and create this synthetic spike protein, which in corporate media, the corporate media that will go there, and in much of alternative media, the narrative is that this deadly spike protein is wreaking all the havoc. And Scolio may be wrong, but I've listened to him speak on this a number of times, and his research seems quite sound. And it seems like this is pointing to another problem within the health freedom movement, if you want to call it that way, or the COVID truth movement, whatever you want to term it, that a lot of these narratives about the dangers we're facing don't hold up to scrutiny when they're put under a microscope, metaphorically speaking, and I suppose literally speaking. So Scolio points out, for example, that no one's blood has ever been drawn and had a synthetic spike protein isolated from it. This is not in the literature at all, as far as he's examined, but there are doctors out there like Peter McCullough, for example, claiming that this is absolutely the case. And I want to point out the problem in the difference of narratives there and the fear-mongering that intentionally or unintentionally causes, and also highlight the idea once again that what we're told about this technology, both in corporate and in a lot of alternative media, is not necessarily the case. But your response to that?
Yes, I would say first that Scolio is not the only one who's making that assertion. You know, you are correct. He is making that assertion. And a big part of what some of these other people are saying on that specific issue, but also to the broader issues of, say, disagreement within the health freedom movement, is let's have this discussion. Scoglio, he's pretty firm in his hypothesis, but he's not so entrenched where he says, this is my hypothesis, go away, I don't want to talk to you. He's saying, look, I want to have this discussion with these other individuals like Peter McCullough, like Ryan Cole, and so forth. Let's debate this openly and hash it out. And it's an interesting dynamic in that it's kind of reflective of the dynamic that happens between those who are in at the front and center of the COVID pandemic. What would you call it? The COVID pandemic industrial complex, the Faucis and all these people. They just utterly dismiss anything that Ryan Cole would say, or that even Robert Malone would say, or even someone as milquetoast as Martin Kulldorff. And yet these individuals will dismiss something that Dennis Rancourt will say, that Scoglio will say, that David Rasnick might say. And so they're sort of leveraging the same social dynamic there. And, I would ask that they take a step back, and I would include Robert F. Kennedy Jr. too. They all need to take a step back and say, you know what, we're, perpetuating the same dysfunctional dynamic and stonewalling these other individuals, just as we've been stonewalled on the other end by, the pharmaceutical Department of Defense spokespeople, right? So that is, unfortunately, I think, clouding the picture quite a bit right now. It's really not allowing, the larger public, of which I include everyone, to understand the totality of the fraud that has been perpetuated upon us for the last couple of years, last 3 years, okay, and going back even more so, but it's at hyper speed right now, and so in essence, there's a lot of narrative reinforcement through this dynamic that occurs by those who are considered to be, the biggest megaphones in the COVID dissent movement, so from most of those individuals that I mentioned, and as well, going to Del Bigtree or, this whole collection of individuals like this, they, through their language, perpetuate the idea that there was a pandemic. They perpetuate, they say it openly. They believe that COVID is a very real problem. For anyone who had the chance to hear Dennis Rancourt be interviewed by RFK Jr. just this past week, and if you haven't, I really strongly suggest you do. That was just a fascinating illustration of this very dynamic, which we're speaking to, where Dennis Rancourt, who's a Canadian researcher, scientist, and so forth, has done some amazingly detailed studies on mortality over the last what he calls the COVID period, okay, starting on March 11th, 2020. And he's done the detail, which is just related to excess deaths. He doesn't go into causation. He doesn't do anything that can get in the way of just looking at these exact numbers. And this is in the US, where the data is very good for just who died, when they died, where they died, even down to the county, okay? The data is crystal clear. On the causation, the data is quite muddy in the US. But in any case, Rancourt is in this discussion with RFK Jr. and he's presenting this information. and his documentation is fairly unassailable. And Kennedy has a real hard time even engaging in what I would call an intellectually honest back and forth on these issues. And there was a very interesting part in the discussion which related to Northern Italy, and you know, the viral spread and this part of the issue, and you know, the excess mortality in Northern Italy, and
this was in Lombardy in early 2020.
It was in Lombardy, but Kennedy said Tuscany. So, you know, he did get that part wrong, but that's, you know, that's maybe being a little too nitpicky there. But what he was saying is that was the primary reason why we knew that there was this virus galloping through and killing lots and lots of people. That's almost a direct quote. And so he's referencing Northern Italy as here is essentially what happened with the viral spread and how that brought to our attention this viral spread in the Western world. Well, Rancourt essentially says, no, it doesn't work that way, and here's why. So we go to 15 minutes later in the discussion, and RFK says that, exact quote, "I don't know much about Italy either than the news reports and having been over there and people having the impression that it wasn't what was happening in the hospitals that was killing people, okay? And people were dying in their homes and just, you know, the virus was what was killing them, okay? So then if you kind of see that, you realize, wait a minute, this individual just told me here is his hypothesis and what he has pushed, okay? Someone with a big voice, he has pushed happened in Northern Italy as relates to mortality, as relates to the virus. And this is a foundational building block of the whole COVID narrative, okay? And here we are 15 minutes later, he openly admits in the very same interview, "I don't know much about Italy either other than the news reports." That's his exact words. So there's some cognitive dissonance there. And the cognitive dissonance comes from the fact that this entire sector of the, you know, COVID dissident health freedom movement believes there was a pandemic. They believe it was caused by a virus. They believe this virus is the COVID, even though COVID's just a set of symptoms, you know, but that's, and that's what they say. And they're flat wrong. They are just flat wrong on this. When you look at, and there I'm not even talking about this discussion about virology or do viruses actually exist. I'm simply talking about the data and the evidence that illustrates there was no unique viral pathogen that caused a pandemic. There's no lab leak. There's no gain of function. There's no, you know, Wuhan boogeyman that did anything. And right. That's the evidence.
Right. It's unequivocal when you drill down into it. And I would argue that you don't have to drill that far down into it to find the evidence proving that there was no pandemic and there was no viral pathogen even afoot. If you go back to one of the first papers to come out of China, although it was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in January of 2020, I have it right here in front of me, "A Novel Coronavirus from Patients with Pneumonia in China 2019, which interestingly, if you expand the list of authors, one of the last ones listed is George F. Gao, who is the head of the Chinese CDC and also participated in Event 201. He's the second to last author listed on this paper. You go through the methods section, it's aside from all of the chemical problems with treating this cell culture, these problems which are in every method section claiming isolation of a virus, it starts with the presumption that the patients they're looking at are experiencing pneumonia caused by a virus. So there's no attempt to determine if a so-called virus is causing their so-called abnormal pneumonia. The assumption from the start is that it is a so-called virus. And then you get to what's quite amazing, although, as I've said many times on this program, it's hard to be amazed nowadays. You get to, it's the last paragraph, and it's the first sentence that reads, "Although our study does not fulfill Koch's postulates, our analyses provide evidence implicating 2019 nCoV in the Wuhan outbreak." So they admit in this paper, which then went on to inform essentially every paper that came afterward in a way, they admit that Koch's postulates were not fulfilled. There was nothing was proved with regard to viral transmission. All they really proved was that these people had pneumonia, and they didn't find the cause of it, but the material taken from these people was then claimed to be an isolate, put into a computer program for metagenomics, and a sequence was obtained and shared around the world. And this supposedly was the sequence that was assembled by the computer, the sequence for that particular strain, quote unquote, the Wuhan strain of SARS-CoV-2. And this fraudulent narrative is the same one that's being pushed, whether they know it or not, by people like RFK Jr., by entities like Children's Health Defense, by people like Steve Kirsch, by people like Peter McCullough, Ryan Cole, and everything they bring up to say, well, we do have distinct symptomology of a disease, COVID-19. They claim it's been isolated, that it's been seen under an electron microscope, never mind the problems with electron microscopy imaging. But they also claim that, well, look, you have ground glass opacity in the lungs, which has been seen in many parts of the world. Failing to note that that does not prove or require a virus, a so-called virus, to happen. It's fundamentally misinterpreting, I argue, what causes pneumonia and how pneumonia acts, the active mechanisms of pneumonia. And when I bring this up, and it's not asking people, well, do you believe in viruses or do you not? But when I bring this up and point out that the viral delusion is the tip of the spear of the COVID-19 operation that's still ongoing 3+ years later, the response I get is, well, it's interesting, but it's a distraction and it's divisive, and we have to think tactically. Catherine Austin Fitz recently said this on a Children's Health Defense program. And I think there are many ways to think about a response to that, but here's one. Well, and she said governments have always used pandemics. The powers that ought not be have always used pandemics, have always weaponized them against the public. So whether or not viruses exist, that mechanism of weaponization is always going to be there. Well, what about weapons of mass destruction, for example, in the case of the war on Iraq, you could say, well, the powers that ought not be, governments always weaponize fears of terrorism against the public. So it doesn't matter if the weapons of mass destruction are actually there or not. That's a preposterous argument. Of course it matters. That's the tip of the spear, I would argue. And with the COVID operation, the tip of the spear is the viral delusion. People believing in viruses and being afraid of viruses when there's nothing to back up, going back over a century, that these entities exist.
Yes, well, I guess I personally bristle at the idea that some of these topics should be off limit, and then who is it that decides for us which topics are to be off limit for whatever reason? You know, they can come up with any reason, you know, tactical, you're not helping the cause, you know, I've heard that sort of thing. And again, I think that speaks to the dynamic which we spoke about earlier. You know, you need to have some capacity for self-reflection. You know, if you're Catherine Austin Fitz, who I actually have a lot of, I think she's done some great work. I have admiration for her. I don't have any heroes, none, no sacred cows. But and some of these other individuals also, I don't want to necessarily discount their work. I do think some of them should be held under a microscope a little bit more. But in any case, they all need to have, and we all need to have a capacity for self-reflection to say, hey, wait a minute, this is the same dynamic that's being leveraged over me by these other entities here. I'm now doing this same thing. Huh. I need to pause and ask myself if that's really the way I want to go. So that's what I'll say to that. I'd like to just kind of go over just a few points why, you know, all some of the tentacles like the lab leak theory, you know, are preposterous. That mm-hmm. you know, you have to accept these concepts to believe in these things. And then I'd like to say a word as to why I think this is very important. You know, I don't want this to be just a academic exercise. Okay, you and I discussing our ideas and hypothesis and saying here's what we have been researching lately. So to start, you know, the first wave of COVID deaths in the U.S., there was a 6-week spike, and it in March and April 2020. And it occurred exclusively in nursing homes, hospitals, and institutions, okay? And some of those institutions, which people just aren't talking about, are, and I'm talking about in the U.S., are public housing authorities for the elderly, okay? And these people were abandoned, okay? So, but, you know, somehow this virus didn't target other places in the rest of the country. The group that was targeted by this virus were the elderly and the sickly, and the median age of death already exceeded the normal life expectancies and four comorbidities. And these individuals were also forced into isolation, abandoned, or given numerous toxic pharmaceuticals beyond what they were already taking in their normal medical regimes. So this seems like this deadly lab leak gain of function virus only impacted those who already had one foot in the grave. And then during this initial wave, only 16 out of the 51 states, including DC, were impacted in any meaningful way. And many of those states bordered one another. So these other 36 states were not impacted during this time. So somehow this virus also observed borders and boundaries. During this time, those impacted were also almost exclusively poor, and many were disabled. So this gain-of-function virus knew enough to stay away from middle class and wealthy people. And then during this time, this virus didn't enter Canada, who had no excess mortality during this time, none to speak of. And that border is about 5,000 kilometers long, and it's one of the most heavily trafficked commercial and personal borders. And the virus seemed to have no lead-in time, so there's no observable evidence for a coming mass death event caused by this virus. So the all-cause death rate leading into the declared pandemic was negative at that point for the United States in 2020, and seemed to spike just in these locations precisely that week when the World Health Organization declared the global pandemic. This lab leak virus caused no mass death in the original place of the lab leak. This gain of function hypercharged virus seemed to migrate to northern Italy from Wuhan, if we're to believe this story, skipping over Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iran, and so forth. So, you know, it seems like this virus had telepathic abilities and geospatial precision. And this virus, once in Italy, did not migrate south or impact other parts of Europe at that time. Instead, from northern Italy, it went to the Elmhurst Hospital in New York. Okay, so that's the short list. There are many other items on that list as to things that, you know, you have to believe, you know, and that really strains credibility. And so now why this is really important that we really get at this, that, you know, there was no pandemic. There simply was no pandemic caused by a unique viral pathogen. And I know if you've written books on this and you've invested, you know, the last 2 years of your lives on this, and you think, you know, this Wuhan story is real, and you've built a little cottage industry around that, it's going to be difficult for you to, you know, to just take a step back and examine this. And there'll be great resistance to it. But, you know, what's kept out of these discussions and what this covers up is the real human tragedy that happened, okay? The lives that were destroyed, okay, in March, April 2020 and beyond, okay? But I'm thinking I'm discussing at this point that period. People were just elderly people, poor people, disabled people were wiped out in nursing homes, hospitals, and so forth. It had nothing to do with the virus. This was administrative slaughter. Mm-hmm. Now, of the things that I am currently and have been doing for some time, I'm involved with the COVID-19 Humanity Memory Betrayal Project. Okay. It's a bit of a clunky name. Okay. It's the COVID-19 Humanity Betrayal Memory Project. So please go to chbmp.org. And what you'll see there are testimonials, firsthand testimonials of many hundreds of people who had loved ones killed by hospital protocols. You can read their testimonials. You can see their videos that they've made. And these individuals are either already at some point of litigation or looking to pursue litigation. And so they have the hospital records, they have everything. So you don't need to speculate on what happened, okay? You will hear it firsthand in story after story after story. And the only reason we only have 600 or 700 is we can't keep up with the number of stories coming in, and we can't get enough people to help document all of the stories coming in. But these individuals were the victims. And if we're sitting here discussing all of these other, you know, false narratives surrounding the COVID, you know, the fraudulent pandemic, we're not really going at the original sins of what happened. And I find that for myself, I find that to be dishonorable to the people who were destroyed by what happened. And there's a bit of a, you know, you're covering this up, okay, wittingly or unwittingly, if you're not focusing on this that happened. And this story, along with many other components which we've discussed, exposes the COVID pandemic for what it wasn't.
Yes, I agree. And I think I agree with you. It's vitally important to acknowledge what you just laid out there as the, I would say, real catalyzing event for the pseudo pandemic. It was the industrial level medical slaughter of people to drive up mortality numbers, to psyop people into thinking that people were dying from a new and novel virus that causes a new and novel disease. And that is absolutely being obscured, whether wittingly or not, by the refusal to look at the viral delusion. And this is not something that's difficult to do. But when you look at, for example, RFK Jr.'s reasons for why he doesn't want to do it, and I believe this was in an email he sent to Dr. Tom Cowan, he talked about, he essentially used financial terms, as Eric Coppolino detailed in a recent Substack piece, "Why is Robert F. Kennedy Jr. running from the missing virus problem?" And he talked about it in terms of cost return ratio, particularly with regard to his credibility and that of Children's Health Defense. And I personally find that very repugnant for an organization that claims to be concerned with the truth and providing the truth on a daily basis, to ignore perhaps the most fundamental of truths about this operation. It's inexcusable, and it needs to be called out. And for people to say, well, that's divisiveness and that's distraction, that doesn't cut it for me. People who say that, I think, are being lazy and dishonest in their approach to figuring out what actually happened and figuring out how to properly resist it and stop it from happening in the future.
Yes, I mean, I guess, I would close with what I have to say, just by saying the message that we must take from these past 2 years is that we are under sustained psychological warfare and have been for quite some time. There was no pandemic ever. The manufactured perception that there was such an event is an artifact of mass media manipulation, behavioral conditioning techniques, and social engineering. As long as good people continue to assert that this manufactured crisis was in fact an actual epidemiological event, the ghouls that concocted this lie will have fertile ground to create the next one, which, rest assured, is in the pipeline. So that, that's a quote from myself, from an article that I had, part of an article that I'd written a while back. And I think that, the bottom line is, people have to be looking at the totality of events and looking at the totality of what is happening around them and understand that the narrative that they're being led, that some are leading them to believe, is also part of the narrative that the biosecurity state wants you to believe.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And just to circle back to where we started with the increase in the acceleration of the mRNA platform. So if these new concoctions aren't hyper-focused now on SARS-CoV-2 in inverted commas, but on more established so-called viruses like RSV, if the narrative is still allowed to proceed that these viruses actually exist, that these illnesses actually exist as viruses, then people will fall into the same trap again of going for injections to treat these so-called viruses. Treat in inverted commas, these so-called viruses. because they've heard, like with the flu, throughout their lives that this is real, this is viral, this transmits from person to person and can cause disease. And as you said, with the shipping out of these products to other countries for a return on investment, that's going to affect people there who believe that these are actual viruses. And don't their lives matter too? We're talking about a global scale here, not just the US. And a lot more we could get into, but I think we covered some very fertile ground. And as I said last time, Michael, I'd love to have you back to continue this discussion. And I hope you'll oblige me, but thank you very much for joining me today.
Thanks, Jesse.